broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Roger Marsh. Roger is a UFO writer and content developer. He is a director of communications for the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, where he manages media contact rights and permissions and content development for television, film, documentary, radio, print, and stage. Roger is a MUFON case researcher for History Channel's Hangar One, The UFO Files. He is the editor of the monthly International MUFON UFO Journal, executive producer of the weekly MUFON UFO Traffic Report radio show. Serves as the MUFON webmaster reporter for the daily UFO Traffic Report and publisher of the MUFON Books imprint. He is the author of Sacred Dialogue, editor of Silent Invasion, and co-editor of Ron Paul Speaks. Roger was featured in the 2015 season premiere episode of Destination America's Monsters and Mysteries in America. And he is a contributor to Huffington Post and Open Minds website. He is also the editor of the new book, UFO Cases of Interest, the 2018 edition. Roger was on this show back in 2012. So let's welcome him back. Hello, Roger.
Hey, David, it's great to be on the show. I can't believe it's been that many years.
I'm afraid it has, yeah. We were just saying. You were saying you were a kid back then, right?
Yeah, just a youngster.
Yeah, okay.
In 2012, my gosh.
Yes, we can't pull that over on our listeners.
No.
But, okay. But we certainly feel like it anyway. 2012, yeah, that was 7 years ago, 7 years.
Wow.
Oh, well.
Never a dull moment, though, in this field. There's always something going on.
I'll tell you. And you stay on top of it. I know that, reading the MUFON Journal. So.
Yeah, always looking for the... We like to feature our best investigation.
Yeah.
Best investigations there. So
right.
That's a great publication.
It is.
If people want to subscribe to it.
It is. And right from the start, if someone wants to join MUFON, someone wants to start receiving the International MUFON Journal, where do they go?
Well, they just go to our website at MUFON.com, and they can sign up for the journal right there.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a less expensive way of doing it. I know you could sign up to get the PDF online and just do it that way, but I prefer, I'm old enough to still prefer holding it in my hands every month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great, 24-page, 8.5 by 11, full color, publication, so it's really nice. It's a little bit more expensive to have it mailed to you every month, but I think it's worth it.
Sure.
So, yeah, just MUFON.com, and they can sign up over there, and it's a great publication. It's a great read. You also get my 6 pages of my traffic report.
What is the traffic report?
Well, it's basically what I kind of nicknamed me covering UFOs. And when I first started back in January of 2009, and for a number of years, I covered only the incoming cases before they were investigated. So I kind of caught a lot of flack for that from really different sides of ufology, like, why are you covering a case, before it's been completely investigated? And back then I used to say, well, you know, if a building catches fire, I'm going to report that there's a fire in town. I don't necessarily know what the cause of the fire was, yet. And, of course, many of the cases I covered, you know, later became solved as knowns, something man-made or something from Mother Nature. And then others, you know, were unknown. So now I switched about a year and a half ago, and I now wait until, and MUFON allows 90 days for the investigation process, up to 90 days. So I wait until a case is closed, and then I cover it. So I'm actually only writing about the best cases now.
Okay. So, yeah, speaking of that, in addition to editing the MUFON Journal, you have also taken over George Feiler's job of posting grassroots UFO reports from around the world.
Yeah, and again, that used to be pulled from my daily reports, you know, as incoming cases, which I kind of think that's what Feiler did, too. They were more or less unresolved cases.
Right.
But now everything you see in the journal, when I replaced Feiler, it's all cases that were closed as an unknown. They're all, you know, fairly good cases in there, so...
Can you give us, give our listeners a few examples of most recent reports that you've covered?
Oh, I'm not sure I'm prepared for that right now.
Ah, I caught you a bit.
I just got back from a 6-week sabbatical, which I've never taken before, and then I sort of got back in the office last Thursday, and then, of course, that's catch-up time,
you know,
trying to get caught up on everything. There's always good stuff coming in, but I could tell your listeners, and it kind of ties into my book, you know, if we'll get to that later in the interview.
Oh, yeah.
But I started something about a year and a half ago called, it's a new project in MUFON called Cases of Interest, because I really felt like MUFON just went year after year, exploring all these cases, resolving them, but weren't really tying them together. They weren't really connecting the dots. So in 2017, I basically combed through, and I had a team that I put together too, and we combed through every case from 2017, and we ruled out, we just ignored all of the knowns and the hoaxes, that sort of thing. And then we looked at only the unknowns, and even from the unknowns, we were kind of careful which ones we picked. Like, I really liked cases that were definitely under 1,000 feet and preferred cases under 500 feet, even under, when they come under 100 feet, they get really interesting. So from all those thousands of cases from 2017, I actually... And my team, you know, I'll throw that out to Phil Leach, who's our former state director in Indiana. He's on my communications team now. We actually picked 241 cases from 2017. That's what became the book. And we created the book, which is an overview of all 241 cases, listed chronologically, you know, January through December. So the book became Cases of Interest, the 2018 edition. So right now we're assessing all the 2018 cases for a 2019 edition, although we're not 100% we're going to produce a book again.
No.
People are just tending not to want to buy books anymore.
Yeah.
So it's still possible we'll do the book, but it might be some kind of an electronic, you know, kind of edition.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
In addition to that, we put another team together, which Phil is also in charge of, which looks at all the incoming cases. And we look at those cases and we kind of pick out cases that we anticipate are going to be good cases. So we basically log them in the same way we do cases of interest. And then we sit and wait the 90 days and go back and shuffle them around. And then once they're closed, they're an unknown, and we like it, then it becomes potential, a potential case of interest for 2019, which would go into the 2020 edition someday. Mm. So lots of, I'm kind of overseeing all this, you know, getting up and off the ground and continuing to do the news feed Monday through Friday on the website. Any of your listeners can go to MoveFund.com, and there's a link at the top of our page, you know, for news.
Okay.
That's the newsroom. And you could actually read about UFOs. Just, there is a UFO news link, but then I have, if there's a really good piece of photography with it, I have a separate series called UFO Photos, another series called UFO Videos, and one of my favorites, the Witness Illustrated UFO. If there's a great illustration, we list it in there.
Well, how do you deal with those photos and videos? It's either, you know, the skeptic always, it's too blurry, they're always too blurry, the object's too far away, and then if you get one, like it's 100 feet away from you, that's too good a picture. It had to be done.
And that becomes suspect, right?
Right. I can do that on my computer in a paint shop, you know, and...
Right, because if you look at some of the really highly, I'm going to call them highly valuable cases that we have, we do know that the object, when it gets that close to you, when it's under 100 feet or it's 50 feet away from you, maybe 50 feet up in the air, that we do know that the object can affect the environment around you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it can cause electronics to shut off. It could cause people to lose time. And that's part of what the book is tracking. When I went to do the book and I was finished with it, I thought logically I should do an index in the back, you know, a location index. So anybody around the country, you could look up your state, your county, your city, and see what did we cover, you know, from your area.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got through the location, or as I was doing it, I started to see a lot of really interesting things in the book pertaining to the object. So I made a second sweep through the book looking for anything related to the object, and I did an object index. And then I went a third sweep through the book, and I did a site index. So different than location, but what actually happened at that site. And then finally, I did a witness index. So that, for example, if you were interested in looking at any of those top cases from 2017, but you only wanted to read reports filed by a pilot or a police officer or a member of the military, you could do that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. What makes a police officer or military personnel more valuable than that of, you know, you and me, Joe Blow down the street? Seriously.
Well, it's kind of like getting a doctor's opinion sometimes on the cold that you've got versus, you know,
grandma's.
Right, than grandma. People do tend to look up to them as being, you know, if you're a member of the military, we kind of assume that you may have training, you know, in a background where you could recognize aircraft, for example. Even we've had aircraft mechanics. We've had just all sorts of different people related to the military, you know, will come forward. And that testimony just does tend to mean a little bit more than just mom or pop.
All right.
you know, but I've seen some great mom or pop, you know, stories
from around the country
that were just, you got to look at these people and say, how could they make this up? It's just, there's just too much detail there, you know. Yeah.
The average person has been around, you know, the older person has been around for a while, has seen conventional objects. They know what they're looking at, and they know what they're not looking at, you know.
Right, and they know their area.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've lived in that same house on that same property for 20, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
and they know what's normal for their area, and suddenly there's, you know, black helicopters coming in at 50 feet, shining spotlights down on their property right after a close encounter, you tend to connect the dots.
Right. Nichols is the skeptic. Joe Nichols, is that it?
Oh, yeah, I love that guy.
Oh, he's super. Yeah, he's this, these pilots are trained observers. They're not trained observers, he says. They're trained to fly. They're not trained to observe. Excuse me, if you're a trained pilot, you better know what's up there in the sky with you.
Right.
In my humble opinion, you know what I'm saying?
But, right. Oh, no.
I think
he also looks into the paranormal, you know, too, as well.
Yeah.
But I have seen him on a few TV shows, Nichols. He did very good at kind of squashing some, like, paranormal reports where people were saying things were going on, and, you know, he found another reason for it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Right brain person, yeah. Do you do your own paranormal investigation?
Well, people in the past have called me a paranormal investigator, and I always downplayed that and said, hey, I'm a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go to a site, and I'll simply interview people, and I'll ask what happened. You know, tell me the story. But I have another book, which I just re-released, called Sacred Dialogue, Tuning into Mother Nature's Natural Broadcast Band. And I've had a lifelong set of paranormal experiences just my whole life, so back to when I can remember, 4 or 5 years old. And so I've had an interest in it, and so I've actually gone to paranormal sites, and what the previous investigators before me told me was going to happen there happened to me in some cases, you know. So it's a little tough. I'm just real low-key about it. I don't like to I don't bring a lot of fancy equipment with me when I go in. I just go in and I observe. I talk to people real low-key, do their interviews. I used to do a lot of this on video. Would love to get back to that someday, but right now I'm just inundated with TV projects.
Yeah.
2019, you're about to see unleashed possibly even dozens of new shows on UFOs coming out.
I'll bet.
A lot of different networks, let me tell you.
What about Hangar One? When is that coming back? Tell me it is.
No, that was a history project that we did, you know, with history, seasons 2015, 2016. I watched from the sidelines pretty much in 2015, and then I got very involved in 2016 because I thought I could improve the show for the second season. So season two in 2016, I would say the content was probably about 70% me in that show, meaning that I picked the cases and got them ready for the writers, and, you know, kind of oversaw it, you know, right through the shooting and, you know, reviewing the show and everything. So that show, they I hope I got the years right, because they kind of bled out that contract. They had a contract for another year, and which never happened through 2017, and they never, you know, agreed to continue the show. So the contract ran out, and we became a free agent again back in probably January of 2018, 17 or 18. I might be off by a year or so there. So we are right now. I can't say which networks But we are working on three different UFO shows for two different networks. Two are brand new. One is a season two. And we're just helping them. It's not like a full MUFON show. But we are in a pre-production type of contract with another network and another production company trying to sell a full-on MUFON show again.
That'd be great.
So it would replace Hangar One.
I thought that Hangar One was one of the, if not the best and most accurate shows on UFOs I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you. It, as long as they were on target with the case, because what I've kind of fought the networks over, and really all of them, I don't like the fact that they keep covering or they want to cover the same cases.
No.
Like over and over and over again. It's like a theater investing, you know, in shows going up in your community, and they're afraid to produce a brand new show, like a new playwright. Mm-hmm. They just want the old and true, you know, musicals that you know everybody's going to come to see. It's the same in television. They're like, well, people, they want to know about, you know, what happened in Roswell, you know,
right.
Was that 1945, I think?
All right.
You know, they want to know what happened out there.
1947,
sorry.
Yeah.
Or Kecksburg, 1965. Mm-hmm. But we've already done it just over and over and over again, and I keep showing them that every year, well, I'm showing them for 2017 in my 2018 edition, here's 241 cases I feel real good about, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, you could go in there and you could really look through and tie some of these cases together, you know, four episodes. So,
yeah. Well, do that.
Right. I just keep banging my fist on the table. So right now we have a network that's very, very interested. We've had a very broad interest from probably, I would say, somewhere between 3 and 4 dozen production companies, mainly West Coast, some of them on scattered different parts of the country or in Europe. And we've kind of back and forth. And we were trying to find a company that wanted an all MUFON show, not just, you know, our material mixed with other material. So we did find a production company and a network that said, hey, let's check it out. Mm-hmm. So we may have news in, you know, another month or two, you know, down the road. I'm hoping.
Have you ever, maybe even you have gotten together with the Black Vault? Oh, help me here now.
Oh, Mr. Greenwald.
Greenwald, yeah. My brain went numb. Greenwald.
Yeah, he just messaged me a day or two ago.
Did he?
It was something on my Facebook page. Oh, it's when we were upgrading my office and tearing closets out in my 1910 home, and three objects popped out of the ceiling and fell down from 1910, and it was one of them was a 1 dozen egg box, like a cardboard egg box, a child's pair of suspenders, and a little doll.
Okay, you say it fell from the ceiling. Was this paranormal
Well, what we think happened in this home, there's a full staircase up to a third floor,
right.
But it's unfinished. It's like your grandma's attic up there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the edge, we think these items probably fell along the edge of the wall down in there, because the closet we were tearing out had a ceiling in it, but we took the ceiling out, and there was probably another, you know, 18 or 20 inches of space before you hit the floorboards on the third floor, and that's where we found this stuff. It kind of fell down, you know, to it. So we think that was probably items they had up in the attic,
sure.
But I think I put a joke up there that I took the egg box and I went to eBay and I saw the same one for $35, and John Greenwald wrote back to me and said, say that it's haunted and you can get $350
yes.
for it.
Yeah, of course.
So I think I wrote him back saying, you know, we were joking about that. I was tempted, but I would never do the ruse.
Lead,
you know,
somebody
like
on, yeah. I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with a UFO researcher, and editor of the MUFON Journal, and many, many other things, some of which I mentioned in the intro, but he's just got his fingers in so many pies, and Mr. Roger Marsh. Roger, now, you brought something up here that I plan on taking advantage of. You said you had a lot of interesting paranormal activity in your life. Give us a few examples.
Oh boy! Well, I will tell the audience. I have a book. The book actually came out maybe 10 or 12 years ago. I just reintroduced it with a brand new cover, you know, little update to it. It's called Sacred Dialogue. You can, you know, it's available over at Amazon under my name, you know, for Roger Marsh. And I think that's a book that I started when I was 40 years old. And my wife knew, even before she married me, that my life was just, my daily life was just full of paranormal activity. You know, things always going on.
Yeah.
So she knew that when she married me. she knew what she was getting into.
Nah.
So I had a habit of, even from the time I was a kid and a teenager, I kind of journaled this stuff. I would write this stuff down. And I kept all that material. And I think I had just turned 40, and I was, of course, working professionally. Back in that era of my life, I was in professional book publishing in the acquisitions department. And my wife thought it was time, you know, go ahead and write the book and get it out there. The people seemed like they were more open to it. So all I could say that the very first chapter in the book goes back to, I kind of do an introduction where I open up to my family and how my parents had had some paranormal experiences, and I talk about that. So when you're growing up, you're kind of hearing these stories in the family. And then I started to encounter this strange activity at night, which later, it wasn't until I was married and it was the 80s, that I interpreted that to mean that possibly I had been abducted. You know, multiple times. So, and I actually got to meet that Harvard professor, John Mack.
Uh-huh.
I spent some time with him reviewing my case, you know, okay, with him. So he was quite fascinated with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point that I make in the book is that in that opening chapter, I kind of take you through that experience that I had and how that changed me. And I always say that it doesn't really matter whether the abduction was real or it was imagined, like it's all in your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's what happened during the process of being abducted, meaning you're communicating with these non-human entities psychically, you know. So you're just thinking and the words are going back and forth. And so things like that then all of a sudden translated over into my very real, you know, human life. And I started, so the book, the rest of the book, the chapters have names like, you know, cemeteries or haunted houses or life and death, you know, things like that. And then the whole chapter is just a series of vignettes, you know, very short pieces about things that happened to me. And I actually have come up with a lecture series I'm going to be doing locally, probably starting in the spring. There's a place near me, a center, that wants me to come down and do this. So I kind of haven't outlined all the various stages I went through, because there was a point when I was early in life that I started blurting things out about people. You know, people would come around me and I would say, "Hey, you're a bank robber, aren't you? You rob banks, you know."
Oh, wow.
And the guy's face turns white and he's starting to sweat. That he was the notorious hat bandit. in robbing banks in my area, you know.
Oh, wow.
I had a job once at a business in Denver, Colorado, one of the suburbs out there, and I had gotten called up to the second floor to the head accountant's office one day, you know, shortly after I started to do my tax paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had filled this form out, you know, my W-2 or whatever they call it. And for some reason, I just turned to the guy, I put my hands on his desk, I leaned in and I said, "You're embezzling money from the company."
Oh,
not only are you embezzling money, I said, you're embezzling a lot of money. And then all of a sudden I stopped. I was like in horror, like, why did I just do that? And I just abruptly, the man never said a word to me. I walked out of his office, walked back to the first floor, went into my office and thought, well, I'm going to get fired. And I waited and nobody came to fire me. And then 2 months later, we find out the guy had embezzled about $250,000 from the company, and they caught him.
Wow.
But so, I was talking about these things.
How old were
so
you?
Those are kind of some of the mild things that happened to me.
How old were you at the time, Roger?
Well, the Colorado case, I think I was 21 years old when that happened.
So basically, you're psychic.
Yeah, and then, but then it's almost like it morphs every 4 or 5 years, and I add some other new dimension to it, because I have some great stories from my 20 years in Chicago.
Well, let's hear one of them.
Well, yeah, I got two. I have a situation where I just would meditate, and I was experimenting. This is all in the book. And I was experimenting with what I just called mental markers. And I would just meditate and say, okay, this is where my wife and I live, and we had a baby at the time. You know, she was still in the crib. And I said, you know, I want to protect my family, so I want to kind of put a little radar around my home, and if anything bad is going to happen, I want to know about it ahead of time. So you just kind of think that, you put these markers in. I've done it in various ways, for all in good success. And so this particular story, we lived on the second floor of a two-flat.
Mm.
And so from the front to the back, you had a living room, a dining room with the master bedroom off of that. Then you had a kitchen behind that with my kids' bedroom off that. And then you had a back door that went out on a huge covered, like an open-air covered porch. And you would go down the stairs, you know, to the first floor. And then there was a sidewalk across the backyard, probably wasn't more than about, you know, 25, 30 feet deep. And then there was a two-car garage that the first floor family used. And then there were two parking spots that we used. And so this one night, I was in the living room. And my wife at that point was in the dining room, and I was watching television, and I always get this real weird feeling, and I turned and I looked through the dining room and the kitchen. I could see the back door, and I see the back door open, and I see a short, kind of pudgy, 60-ish looking man in a long dark coat coming in my back door holding a pistol. Holding a gun in his hand. And I, of course, you know, my baby is in her bedroom right just feet from him. My wife's in the dining room. And, of course, I looked straight, like I stood up and looked the guy right in the face. And right as I looked at him, he just dissolved right in front of me.
Wow.
And so I went to my wife and I said, I kind of programmed that would be 1 hour ahead of time I would see this stuff. So my wife said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think we should get out of here for the night because it's going to happen in about an hour. So we wrapped the baby and the three of us got in the car and we drove to her mother's house and that was it. So the next, well, a couple days later, I was talking with my neighbor who lives directly behind me. Our garages are like back to back. And he was kind of up there in years. And he worked part-time cleaning for the local police department. And he was a big recycler. he would go up and down the alley, and he knew people because he had been there for 30, 40 years, and he knew whose apartment or whose home to knock on, and he had a bag with him, and he would collect aluminum cans. Mm-hmm. So the night that story would have played out at my house, he was in the alley a couple of doors down, same thing, a two-flat, you know, this is Chicago, and he was up on the second floor, had just gone in the door to collect cans, and he was waiting for the people to get them, and all of a sudden this short, pudgy, 60-ish looking guy with a handgun, dark coat, steps in, handgun, robs them all, and leaves. Now, working for the police department, he said this guy was going up and down our alley on different nights, and he would just look for lights on, and then he would walk up and turn your knob. If your door was unlocked, that was his MO. He would just walk right in on you with the handgun.
So he was looking for people with their lights on, right?
Correct. So our lights were all out, so I was able to avoid it. But yet the story came back to me 360 because the exact thing and the exact description came back to me from my neighbor.
Good Lord.
So about 2 weeks had passed, and I'm in the same position in my living room. And again, I get that funny feeling, but this time my sight, and this happens to me once in a while, my sight disappears. And I have a brand new sight. And this sight was coming from somebody who was out in our parking area. And at that time, I drove a little Japanese-made pickup truck, a little two-door pickup truck. I think it was a Mazda. And they had popped open, because it was locked, they popped open my driver's door, and they were kind of stooped down, and they were looking at the aftermarket radio in my car. They were about to pull it out, and this young man was looking through the windshield of my car, which was, you know, face in, and he was looking at the two back doors on the two flat, you know, first floor, second floor, and he was extremely nervous. So I could actually feel his whole body. I could see what he was seeing. So I ran through the apartment telling my wife that there's somebody out there. I had a vision that there's somebody out there stealing the radio out of my car. And my wife caught me before I got to the back door, and she said, Roger, in this town, because she grew up in Chicago, she said, they'll kill you over $5. Don't go out. So I paused just for a couple seconds, and then I went to the door, my back door, and I just started jiggling it. I made a lot of noise with it. And I waited about 30 seconds, and then I turned the knob, stepped out on that big open air, you know, covered porch, and I looked across the lawn at my Mazda pickup truck, and here the driver's door was hanging open, interior light was on, but nobody in sight. I had scared them away with the noise, and I simply, my wife didn't want me to do this, but at the time I just walked down and looked around, didn't see anybody. I saw the truck. You know, I looked in, you know, my radio was still intact, built into the dashboard, and I just locked the truck up for the night, never had another problem again with it.
Jeez. Well, you know, you're lucky on one level, another level, that could get you killed one day.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. I don't know what would have happened. The only difference, if I had just bolted out there, I kind of think that, seeing somebody coming, he would have just bolted, I think.
Probably, but you don't know.
But my wife was erring on the side of caution. She didn't want to lose her husband, over a $75 radio,
No.
So, but we had the evidence that something was going on, and I saw it from a point of view where I couldn't naturally see it, but I did.
And all of this is in your book?
It's all in the book. That was just one style of experimentation. I then started doing experiments with one particular colleague, if you want to hear just a couple more.
Yeah, please.
If we have time.
Well, let me do this, Roger.
Go ahead.
Let me take a moment again to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. That's 89.3 FM. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell. We're speaking with UFO and paranormal researcher, Mr. Roger Marsh. Go ahead with a couple more of these stories.
Well, I'm now pretty open in my life. It's the 90s, and so I go out to lunch with colleagues, and I'm telling them these stories from my past.
Mm-hmm.
And this one particular colleague just got extremely interested in my stories. And she said that, could you do an experiment where you can kind of zero in on somebody like myself, she said, and look into my future?
Mm.
And I said, well, you know, I'll give it a try. I certainly don't want to do that for a living, or I don't want to, you know, I never want to be the dog and pony show at the circus, you know. But I said, I'll give it a try. So I went home that night and I did a kind of a private meditation, because she said at 8 o'clock tonight, I'm going to be somewhere in Chicago, and I want you to describe where I'm at and who I'm with, and describe the environment. She told me nothing else. So I went home and I went into a meditation, and all of a sudden the scene popped up, and I saw her with, I'm going to say, this is on recollection now, I'm doing it, so I might be a little bit off, but she was seated in a restaurant-looking place, and she was actually in the center of the room. And I remember this really heavy, like, high-end paneling, you know, on the walls around the room. And the tables in the room were round. She was in the center of the room, very well-dressed, with five other women at this table. And I looked at the table, and they were apparently drinking tea, I thought. But what was interesting, I thought, was all the teacups on the table were black teacups. And then it all faded. So I wrote all these details down, and the next morning, I had it all typed and printed out. I'm holding it in my hand. And I said, well, all right, at 8 o'clock last night, I did my thing. What were you actually doing? And she said, well, I'm getting married in a few weeks, and I took the women who were going to be in the wedding with me, you know, the maids of honor or matrons of honor, bridesmaids, I guess you'd call it.
Right.
I took them out for tea, and I went to such and such place, and she said that, and she kind of was describing the room, and I said to her, well, what shape were the tables in the room? And she said, round. And I said, positioned in that room, were you off to, you know, the north wall, the south wall, east, west, where were you? And she said, oh, no, we were like right dead center of the room. And then I said to her, what, were you drinking tea? And she said, at one point, yes, early on. And I said, well, what color were the teacups? Black. So, wow. And I pulled it out, and I had it all typed out for her.
Wow.
So I freaked this out. Let's just say, I kind of freaked her out. So she said, could we do this one more time? And she said, could you just broadly look into my life, like another, just go 24 hours into my future, okay? I can't remember how many days we said, let me revisit that. But she just said, could you look into my future? So that night I did another meditation. I typed it all up. And I came in, and I said, well, this is from your future. I said, it hasn't happened yet. So I was kind of on stage at that point instead of her.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm seeing a boulevard in Chicago, you know, where you can park on both sides of the street. And I said, I see your, because I knew her fiancé, and I knew what kind of car he drove, and it was a deep forest green color. And I said, I saw his car parked on the, you know, I was kind of looking down the boulevard, so it was on my right, and it was about mid-block, his car was parked, and then I see a U-Haul van with two men of Mexican, you know, heritage driving it, and the two Mexicans, men, were wearing flannel shirts, and they're coming down the boulevard, and the driver got distracted, and he sideswipes your fiancé's car.
Hmm.
So again, I've got this all written down, And she looks at it and she says, well, it hasn't happened yet. So she takes the, you know, information, folds it, says thank you, and we went on, you know, with our lives. Well, here a couple of days passed and she came into work and she said, well, you're not going to believe what happened. She said, I had my the women, you know, in my wedding party, we went in for a dress fitting. And we timed it so that my fiancé was going to meet me there, kind of right toward the end of the dress fitting. And he parked across the street, you know, his dark green, you know, sedan.
Right.
And he came across the street, you know, to see if we were done yet. And so we were, like, inside the building, she said, you know, maybe 15 or 20 minutes. And then we were going to go to dinner afterwards after we said goodbye to everybody. And she said, here, we walked outside, we crossed the street, and by God, she said, just like you said, it was a hit and run. Somebody had sideswiped the vehicle, but she said, we have no idea if it was a U-Haul van, if the men were Mexican and were they wearing flannel shirts.
Mm.
But she said, it happened. So I'm like, wow.
No.
And I guess her fiancé was not a believer, but when he heard that I had written that down and she saw that in advance of it, other than me going out and being the one to sideswipe his car.
I was going to say, he's going to blame you.
he was pretty impressed. Well, a couple days passed and she came into work and she said, now you're not going to believe this. She said there was actually a witness to the accident, and there was a woman. And when she witnessed the accident, she went to the local police department right there in Chicago, and she reported it. And she said that it was a U-Haul van that hit your car.
Wow.
And the police officer that was, you know, said that he had then gone to investigate U-Hauls in that area, and did anything come in with damage on the front right of the vehicle. And, of course, they tracked it down. They found one that was turned in with that kind of damage. And they went to the man that rented it, and of course, him and his buddy, they were Mexican. And they just admitted it, that they did it.
Wow.
So the only piece of that story we didn't have an ending to
was, flannel shirts.
Did they have flannel shirts on?
I'll bet if I were a gambling man, I bet they were. They did have that. Have you ever...
So I've got a lot of stories like that.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of had fun with it, and I did different experiments, and I tried different things with it. It's all positive for me. It's, you know, but if you go, it's. I think what's interesting to me about the book is how the paranormal, which to me is just normal things happening. I don't get, you know, I don't go for all that weird music that they play on the TV shows.
Nah,
like,
nah, nah,
you
nah,
know,
nah.
Something's coming.
Yes, right.
It doesn't happen.
Right.
But I started my life out blurting things out, and probably the biggest weird thing I did, I was in the fifth grade, and at Mountain View Elementary School in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and it was, school year 67 to 68, so it was near the end of the school year in 68, and we were trying to think of things to do near the end of the year for fun. And I had been reading from the school library plays, and I love to write, you know, short stories and things. And I had, in fact, I had written a short story earlier in that year, because I had heard that NASA was sending astronauts into space for the first time over the Christmas holiday. Mm. And I wrote a story about how Santa Claus had to go out in space and deliver the toys, you know, to the astronauts. So they liked it. They read it to all the classes that year. So I was kind of feeling good as a writer, even in the fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked the school if I could write a play, a comedy. And they said, sure. And we agreed on the date that we were going to perform it. So I wrote the play at home. And then we, you know, got everybody that was going to be in the play. I cast it. And we had time to practice it, you know, during lunch breaks, you know, playground breaks. And so we were supposed to perform the play on the morning of June 5, 1968. And that particular morning, my family overslept. And so we had a TV set that was running in our eating area off the kitchen over, you know, breakfast. And so national news probably would have been on, and we would have seen what was happening. So I ran all the way down to school because I thought I was late. And I got there, and all the kids in school were inside the building already, except the teacher that they had assigned to my play to oversee it, and all the kids that were in the play. And they were all on the front steps of the school, and everybody was crying. And I got there, and the teacher looked at me and said, "Roger, we're not putting your play on today." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because it really happened." And my play was, there was a presidential race going on at the time, and John Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, was running for office. And he was quite popular that summer. And, of course, my family was Catholic, and they wanted to see a Catholic get into office. And anyway, I had written a play where he had been assassinated before he was elected. And I had just described it as a foreignish man shot him in the head and killed him. And it, believe me, it was a comedy, but this was the ending of the play, of Kennedy being assassinated. And we were performing it on the morning of June 5, 1968, and he was killed after midnight the morning of June 5, 1968. Of course, that was in California. But it did happen after midnight, so my dates matched up. So, of course, everybody looked at me like, what?
How did you know? Good luck.
How did you know? And, of course, I just played it off like, oh, coincidence.
Right.
Presidential candidate, you know.
Other than that.
Other than that, and then things just started happening, you know, pretty much on a regular basis, right down to my whole family knowing about it. So anytime something strange would be going on, you know, they all eyes would go on me.
Have you ever tried meditating on extraterrestrials, their reality, where they're from, what do they want, etc.?
No. I mean, I suppose it's possible to do that or do anything.
Well, I'm
just pretty much a laid-back person. I love the research that I do, but kind of when I meditate, it's just kind of me, you know, just me exploring life and, you know, what I'm trying to do.
Well, that is your homework here from We Are Not Alone. Your assignment, should you decide to accept it.
Okay. I might as well do What is the Meaning of Life?
Right. That's right. Yeah, but that would be interesting, I should think. Just apply that ability to, you know, what are you guys doing here? Bug eyes, you know?
Right. No, it is the subject. We don't know going forward. It's nice that we have some, at least some information out of the Pentagon in the last year or two.
Yes.
That not only, I mean, they, according to what we hear through the media, is they're at least acknowledging that UFOs exist.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing MUFON says. We just don't understand the intelligence behind it. That's all.
Right.
And the closer you look at ufology, the closer you study it, the weirder it gets.
Really?
It just keeps getting weirder and weirder and weirder. Yeah. So I really don't quite understand what it is we're studying out there.
Yeah.
And I
always say for every answer you get, there's 10 more questions posed. Huh?
Exactly.
So
that, you got it. 10 more questions every time you think you get somewhere.
So what effect, if any, do you think the 2 years to the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, as well as the Pentagon's recent admissions, has on the general general public when it comes to acceptance of the UFO reality?
But I think it's all positive. I think that what they're doing is just helping set the stage for where we need to go, which is having all the universities in this country start to put together programs for studying these things and doing serious scientific studies, which most people at, you know, most professors out there, you know, from many different, you know, areas of science, they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, as they say, because they'll just be laughed, you know.
The third rail.
Yeah, but then you did have people like John Mack at Harvard, you know, step forward and say, hey, look, you know, everybody, I'm studying, you know, the abduction process. Mm-hmm. And they took him seriously, and he got funding. Not a lot of funding, but, you know, he was allowed to move forward, you know.
But you do notice who he was replaced by after his untimely death, well, that Susan Clancy, that just totally 180 degrees. Her position was 180 degrees. And
Not aware of that. Okay, Susan Clancy. I'll have to look that up.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, she was Harvard's gal after that. And oh, yeah, and she just said, yeah, that's nothing to this at all.
Yeah, well, I know he did have colleagues that were upset with him, and he was a little bit ostracized at the time.
Yeah, but they did
we
not...
all knew that, but it wasn't 100%. There was hope there, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They did not fire him. They were going to, but they did not fire him.
Yeah. No, he was doing good, and I just feel so bad. He did that lecture over in London and got hit by a Peugeot, you know. I just was very upset over that. That happened probably about 2 years after I met with him.
Yeah.
And, my wife was having some work done at Harvard University at their cyclotron center on a brain tumor.
Mm.
And we had to actually live up there for 3 months while she was doing that.
Mm.
And so I started walking around Harvard, and then it hit me that he had an office on campus. I looked him up and made a phone call to see if I could get an appointment with him and explain my position. And by God, he saw me.
That's great. That is great. Yeah.
Yeah. He really liked my case too. He was hoping that I would, you know, try to go further into it. But, you know, you get caught up, you're raising a kid and, you know, you have a job and, you know, you're a homeowner and you're doing all kinds of things that you just don't always have time for everything.
No,
you
don't.
In life.
No, not when you got kids.
It's certainly been, fascinating. But then came, what was that, 2006, I decided to just stop everything I was doing and concentrate on ufology, you know, 100% in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any way out for me right now. I think I'm still, I turned 62 in a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's it. I'm going to stay with it now.
Very good. Very
I don't
good.
Know that I'll ever retire, as they say.
Roger Marsh, where can we go? Where can our listeners go to find out more about your work, your books?
I would send everybody over to MUFON. That's MUFON, MUFON.com. And there is that center link at the top of the page for news. You can click on that. There's a drop-down menu. And all the work that I do is right there. There is a promo on the right side of that homepage for my book. You can click and go right over to Amazon, you know, for UFO Cases of Interest. And that book is, I believe that's $29.95 over at Amazon. But also, if you use my name, Roger Marsh, and look up, my other book, and that is called Sacred Dialogue, and that one, I think that is $24.95.
Okay.
And David, I'd be glad to mail you copies of these two books too, so you have them.
Ooh, I would appreciate that, sir.
Maybe after the show, just email me a snail mail address, and I'll get those. I'll get those in the mail to you soon, so you've got them in case you ever want me back on the show again.
Oh yeah, excellent. Roger Marsh, thank you very much for joining us, and I hope we can do this again.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me, and I hope to come back one day soon.
Very good. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 o'clock noon, when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Guys and dolls, you are at the malt shop with Daddy G here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And we are going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop where the jukebox is playing. The kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.